I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Arts and Ideas at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is veteran broadcast journalist Leslie Stahl. And now, join Marcy Glazer on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Leslie Stahl.
Good evening. I'm Marcy Glazer, the Interim Executive Director of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to this evening's program with Ms. Leslie Stahl. She is one of our most respected journalists. Her career took off in the 1970s when, as a rookie at CBS News, she was asked to cover a minor break-in at a Washington hotel. This burglary, of course, led to Watergate, and she found herself in the middle of one of the most defining moments in the history of this country and of investigative journalism. In the company of the toughest, most competitive reporters in the country, Leslie Stahl forged her signature style. She's held the coveted position of CBS White House news correspondent for over 13 years and four presidential terms, reporting on such major stories as Jimmy Carter's Middle East peace accords, the attempted assassination of Ronald Reagan, and the Supreme Court nomination of Sandra Day O'Connor. In 1983, she began moderating Face the Nation, interviewing such international leaders as Boris Yeltsin, Margaret Thatcher, Yasser Arafat, and Daniel Ortega. In 1991, she joined the august ranks of 60 Minutes, a position she calls one of the best jobs on television. She appears tonight in conversation with the JCCSF's own Director of Arts and Ideas, Barbara Lane. Please welcome them both to our stage.
Wow. So many of you.
Wow. It's because of you.
Oh, thank you for coming.
Thank you so much for being here tonight. So we arranged for you to come quite some time ago, and as sometimes happens, there's a story in the news today that is very much a Leslie Stahl story, because you did a really great and sort of revealing interview with James Risen, and we find out now that Jeffrey Sterling, the former CIA officer, was convicted of leaking material to Risen, who of course refused to reveal his sources. So give us your reaction to this new development and a little background on that story.
Well, James Risen is a New York Times correspondent who refused to testify in this trial about a leak. Of course, you all know that he would stand up for the First Amendment. He did a 60 Minutes story, and he said on television, "I will never reveal my source ever, ever, no matter what." I think the conviction shows that they didn't need his testimony. He never did testify. And he kept saying, "They don't need me, they don't need me." So it was an exercise in futility, really. The Attorney General decided himself, finally, after putting Jim Risen through the hoops for about 2 years, he finally said, "We're not going to do that." And ironically, the producer at 60 Minutes, who worked on the Jim Risen story, himself then faced a threat of subpoena in another case. And when they withdrew the Jim Risen threat, they also withdrew for my producer. His name is Rich Bonin. So.
Well, it became a bigger story, too, because it was a rallying point for news organizations.
Absolutely.
As it should have been.
As it should have been.
So going back a little bit, what I didn't know when I started preparing for this interview is that you were a graduate student in zoology at Columbia and wanted to become a doctor. What happened?
Well, I know a lot of you in the audience will understand. When I was taking comparative anatomy and he wouldn't touch anything. And the lab assistant said to me, "Miss Stahl, if you're not going to touch anything, how are you going to be a doctor?" And I went, "Oh, be a doctor. I'm not going to be a doctor."
So you made a turn.
Well, you know,
and went to work for John Lindsay.
Well, I answered an ad in the New York Times. I then went out to look for my first job, and there was I had majored in history in college, and there was a little notice that said researcher. And I knew I loved researching, and I answered the ad, and I went to work for the speechwriter of the mayor of New York, right out of the New York Times.
Wow.
I know.
And he was John Lindsay, because I remember living in New York, growing up in New York, he was quite a glamorous figure. They called him the Republican Kennedy. And he was sort of, they covered everything he did. He was tall, he was handsome, he was dynamic.
Gorgeous. He was the most beautiful man. I remember when I got my job, the speechwriter walked me in to meet the mayor. And his back was to me when I walked in, and he spun around on a swivel chair. And I went, "Wow, this is a good-looking man." He was beautiful. He really was beautiful.
Right.
And he got in a lot of trouble as mayor over the garbage strike. So I think the new mayor, de Blasio, is having his test today with the snowstorm.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Mayors. Aren't you glad you're here?
I'm very glad I'm here, for many reasons.
So after that, you went to 1972, you went to Boston, and you worked on Channel 5 in Boston.
1970,
got that wrong. Thank you.
Well.
And you auditioned for CBS News, and you were hired by Bill Small. And you said that becoming a journalist meant surmounting your femaleness and your blondness.
Well, sure. This was in the very, very, very early days of affirmative action. They hired me because of affirmative action, no question. And there were very few women in positions of authority on television. And so I had to lower my voice. I was not allowed to smile. Really, as a woman, I was not allowed to smile. And, you know, I knew that I had to overcome my looks, both maintain my looks and overcome them at the same time. And that was a little difficult. But I had my mother in my corner, constantly telling me to take my glasses off so I would have dates. And I felt I should have my glasses on to look authoritative. No, that really, it wasn't funny at the time to find a voice that really, it wasn't mine. And all the women did this at that point.
You were really close to your mother. In fact, in the beginning, for quite some time, you called her after
every
newscast.
Oh, not only after every newscast, maybe 3 or 4 times a day. She picked my clothes till I was 35. She did. She just, this was her career. This is the truth. This was my mother's career.
Was she a screenwriter or?
Well, she attempted to be a screenwriter.
I see. So that was what she really wanted to do. But she was your wardrobe consultant.
She did not work, and she should have. She was smart. She was all together, and she was bored as you can be in the suburbs outside of Boston. And she didn't want me to have to go through that kind of life.
Yeah. So when you got to CBS, Dan Rather was there, who's been here with us, Daniel Shore, Marvin Kalb, Roger Mudd. Was Connie Chung there at that
Connie
time?
Connie and I were hired together.
Ah.
There were 3 of us hired under affirmative action in 1972. Connie, Bernie Shaw, do you remember Bernie? And me. And we were the affirmative action babies. And we didn't even have an office. Everybody else had an office, all those stars, and we had those little baby desks in a corridor, and we couldn't sit at them. They were really little baby desks. They were enough to put something on. You could put your papers on them, but we couldn't work there.
And so the welcome from the boys?
I got a great welcome from the boys. They were, I felt, committed to the program of affirmative action. You know, when it was first passed in the early 70s, it was extremely popular in the country. Most people were for it. I really honestly felt that I was hired. They wanted us to succeed. They did not want us to fail, and they helped us. We were apprentices. This is a system that has gone away. It should be brought back, not just in journalism, but in a lot of different professions where you are actually brought in and you work at someone's elbow and learn what they do, not because they're constantly explaining it to you and teaching you, but because you observe. You're right next to them and you observe constantly. I was apprenticed. So was Connie. So was Bernie. And we all three did succeed. Mm-hmm. We stayed. We survived.
But there was a lot of competition, whether it was male, female, or not. For example, on the Watergate story, which was the hottest story of its time, there's a story in your book about Sam Donaldson and his crew who bodily removed you from an interview. What happened?
They picked me up and put me over here. I thought you were going to talk about the time when Sam and I were staking out John Dean, who remembers Watergate. And he was testifying before the grand jury. And all of a sudden, in those days, believe it or not, reporters could just sit right outside the grand jury room. We sat on the floor right outside the grand jury room. And the doors flew open. There were doors, two doors like that. And out he came, and he had protection. He had guards. And he came out, the guards walked him out, and we thought it was over. We thought this was the end. So Sam and I jumped up and ran after him. He went into the men's room. And Sam went in too. And I remember this door coming right into my face, and it said, M-E-N. And I really hesitated. I hesitated. Should I go in there? And I'm such a wimp, I didn't go in there.
Oh, you didn't?
I did not. No.
So when he removed you from this interview, it was because he wanted the interview, and you were just...
Well, as I remember it, he had a camera and was interviewing someone. I came up, saw that he was doing the interview. It was in a public place. I didn't have a camera crew, but I joined anyway. He just physically, I remember, the arms came in, you know, he was behind me and they came in.
Well, you're tiny. I could see that happening.
It's very funny.
So you have said there are two kinds of reporters. There are those like the late Charles Kuralt, with whom you worked, who wrote so well he could spin a good story out of one or two bits of information. Then there's the other kind, door kickers, like me. Not the men's room door, but door
right,
kickers.
So
give us a couple of examples of when you've really had to kick down the door.
Well, I guess what I meant was that if I needed more than just a couple of snippets. I needed real meat. I needed a big, thick steak of information to get a story going for me. And so I was on the phone all through Watergate, and then afterward, when I covered the White House, I would make 20, 30 calls a day. I would just have to get the story and then put meat on the bones. You know, today, there's no time to think. Reporters get a story, and they have to run to a camera immediately and tell whatever they've gotten. And it could be a tiny little corner of a story. They don't really have time today to develop it and make an arc, make a full statement on it. Here's the pros, here's the cons. But we did have time.
Yeah.
And I took the time to work the phones.
Speaking of Watergate, other than the national and international significance of that story, it's very important for you because you met your husband, Aaron Latham, who was a magazine writer, and he was working on a Watergate story as well. And Aaron Latham, of course, the name you all might know, he first came into prominence, I believe, because he wrote the Urban Cowboy story for Esquire magazine. So tell us how that happened.
And how I met him?
Yeah.
A love story?
Yeah.
Okay. I hope you're not bored to death. He was writing for New York magazine at the time in New York. And his boss said, you know, we should have some corner of this Watergate story. This was when it was on television every day in the Senate hearings. So he came down, and he covered the hearings, and he very quickly realized that anything he was learning, the whole country was watching at the same time. So what kind of a story could he write? And someone said that he should call me because I had covered it from the very beginning, and I had all kinds of information that CBS didn't want because they only wanted the hard, hard stories, and I was spending so much time, I knew little sidebars. So he said to this person, "Who is she?" So he watched me on television that night just to find out who I was, and he came. He called me. That's right. He called me on the phone at home. And I said, "How did you get this home number?" And he said, "Well, from a mutual friend." And I said, "Look, if it's work related, call me tomorrow at the office." And as he tells the story, he said to himself, "I'll never call that bitch again as long as I live." However, he went back to the hearing the next day, and he still had no story, none whatsoever. So he swallowed his pride, and he called me. In the meantime, I had checked up on him. I found out everything about him, so he called, and he knew it was going to just be a pain in the bottom. Except I said, "Want to have dinner?" because I had checked him out.
Your mother was proud, I'm sure.
I'm sure she was proud. So that's how we met. And I had so much material that he wrote this brilliant column, just all based on what I was telling him. So his boss was so happy with it that he sent him back every other week from New York to Washington. We became best friends. He took me out to dinner every other week, and I gave him all my stories. And we just became best friends until we weren't best friends. We were just...
Well, you write... You write very movingly in your book, Reporting Live. You're candid about the fact that he suffered from depression. And it was so interesting. Mike Wallace, who was a good friend of yours, really sort of helped you through that. And
he was unreal. You all know that Mike Wallace went public with his own depression. And this was at a stage way later than Urban Cowboy. Many years later, we were married, we had a child, and he fell into this a dark pit, and he would not see a doctor. He just wouldn't. There was no way to convince him that he really could get help. He wasn't going to do it. He's a Texan. Explains all of it. And one day, I was in New York. I wasn't at 60 Minutes yet. And very casually, Mike said, "How's Aaron?" And I said, "He's depressed." And he said, "He's seeing a doctor." And I said, "You know, Mike, he won't. He won't do it." And Mike physically grabbed me by the shoulders, and he said, "You find a way. You find a way. You have to get him to the doctor. You cannot let him suffer another day." And, I mean, he really shook me physically to the point where I knew I had to find a way. So I found a way, and I told my husband that it wasn't a psychiatrist. It was a pharmacologist that he had to go see, and that he had a chemical problem, and that the pharmacologist was going to treat it as if he had diabetes or whatever, that there would be a chemical that he could take to make up for what the deficit was. And he accepted that and went, and I always say Mike saved his life.
Yeah,
he did save his life.
So you were ambivalent in the 70s, I guess, about covering the women's movement because you thought it would typecast you. And it was interesting to me that a colleague of yours, Ed Bradley, told you he felt the same way about covering the civil rights movement.
Right.
Interesting.
But the truth is, I was never assigned either. I never had to actually face the... I would never had to say, "No, I won't do it." It wasn't like that. But I didn't go and ask to do it. And, you know, I'm glad I said no, because I would have been so conflicted on the story. Mm-hmm. I would have definitely had a position within my heart. And those are the most difficult stories to cover. I'm not saying I never covered a story where I didn't have a strong opinion and had to fight against it. But that would have been particularly difficult. I went to a convention, and there was a woman who got up and spoke, and I was standing in the hall, and I just so desperately wanted to scream, yes, yes, but had to swallow it. So that would have been hard to do.
You're listening to veteran broadcast journalist Leslie Stahl on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So moving into the Jimmy Carter years, that's when you started as a White House correspondent. You traveled with Jimmy Carter to the Middle East. It was a time of great promise. And so I wonder what your perspective is on this stalemate, this situation we have now, which seems so intractable.
It's heartbreaking. It's pathetic. It's scary. I was over there, I'm trying to remember what the story was, my last story, and I was so surprised at how the, I don't even know, how much the religious right is how strong they are politically and how rightward they have pushed Netanyahu. It was a big surprise to me that the moderate labor group that we all knew when we were growing up and when I was following that story really has lost so much power. Really, I'm interested to see how this election's going to go.
And what about Boehner's invitation to Bibi?
Wow. In all the years I covered the White House, I can't imagine any situation like this right now. I just can't imagine it. Really, all the presidents I covered, and there were so many differences that they had with Congress when it came to foreign policy, you never saw this kind of split. I can't remember a time when I was in Washington where anything close to this ever happened.
Yeah, it's pretty extraordinary.
It is extraordinary. It's extraordinary. The lack of respect for the office of the president has really come around to a place that kind of hurts me. Mm-hmm. No matter what, and this was true of the press as well, there's the person who's the president, and he embodies that office, and so he is always accorded a degree, a large degree of personal respect. And from the first time that man yelled at Obama, "You're a liar," boy, I've been in shock ever since.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of the president, Jimmy Carter had fine moral character, but as you've noted, not necessarily a prescription for effective governance. And you asked the question in Reporting Live, can a president who hates politics succeed? I wonder if you think there are parallels to Obama. Does Obama hate politics?
You know, I think the question is, do they hate the theatrics of the office, the theatrics of leadership? And I actually don't think that a president who doesn't want to go through the pyrotechnics of what it takes to be on television, what it takes to dance through the vignettes, to show symbolism to the public, I don't think they're going to be a good president. If you look at the presidents in our lifetime who have succumbed to that, Reagan particularly, he totally succumbed to it, but also Clinton, they understood the levers of power and that they can be very visual, and I'd like to tell a story. The idea that how they present themselves in a almost Hollywood way is essential to leadership. We don't want to know that. We don't want to know that they have to perform, but they do. And the ones who shy away from it or think that it's undignified, they never really succeed. And Jimmy Carter just didn't want anything to do with it. I remember even George Herbert Walker Bush was offended by having to pretend that's the right word, and now Obama. And their presidencies were all hurt by this. Mm-hmm. But here's a significant story to tell you. It was Reagan. He was running for re-election. And I did a story at the very end of the campaign, which was all about how he had tried to create amnesia about some of his policies as a book to his policies that had become unpopular. So, for instance, he went to Buffalo, New York, to inaugurate a nursing home. He cut the ribbon. But it was a campaign event, so there was red, white, and blue bunting everywhere, and there were children with flags. And he knew just how to stand so the sunlight hit him in right the place. He was so handsome. And I said, as you saw this spectacle, little would you know from this scene that he tried to cut the budget for nursing home construction. Then he went to the Handicapped Olympics, and it was the same thing. It was a campaign stop, and red, white, and blue, and flags, and a band, and all that, putting the little medals around the kid. Seeing this gorgeous scene, the light again is hitting him just right. And I'm saying, little would you know from this scene that he tried to cut the budget for the handicapped, and he did an environmental event, and I kept pounding away at this for 4.5 minutes. And I thought, well, I've just burned my bridges with the White House. They'll never, because it was obvious he was going to be reelected. They'll never return one of my phone calls. But they loved this story. They loved it. They called me. They thanked me. They said they owed me. And I thought, what? Did you hear what I said in that story? And this was the Deputy Chief of Staff, Dick Darman. He said to me, Leslie, nobody heard what you said in that story. I said, what do you mean? He said, no, they just saw those great pictures of Reagan looking young and virile and, you know, showing force and powerfulness. They didn't hear you at all. Oh. You guys haven't figured it out, but when the visual is powerful and you're saying something that conflicts with it, we drown you out. And I thought, I know he's telling me the truth. Yeah. I know it.
Yeah.
So a friend, and I told everybody in sight this story, and a reporter at the Washington Post set up a focus group, ran my story without me, just the pictures, and 100 people, said it was an ad for Reagan's Morning in America campaign. Then they ran it again with my, you heard me. Half the people said, we just told you it was an ad. They didn't hear me at all. Half of the rest said it was a positive news story.
Wow.
Only a quarter of the people actually heard what I said. So this was a huge lesson for certainly people in journalism. This is now taught in journalism schools, this very story I'm telling you. We learned that we can't be conflicting with the picture. You just can't. And just to run these, we used to call it wallpaper. We'd put up these pictures of the president, whatever he did, whatever it was, just to show it. And we'd say something completely different. So we stopped doing that. But I also learned how powerful those images are, and that a president who doesn't use that lever is not reaching the public. Mm-hmm. And the ones who don't suffer by
right.
it.
Well, speaking of amnesia, it's the perfect segue, because reportedly there were signs during Reagan's presidency that he had Alzheimer's. In fact, you've been quoted saying, we all looked the other way.
Well, it's unclear if he actually had full-blown, but there were little hints along the way. And in fact, I remember the Wall Street Journal, of all publications, had a front-page story asking if he was senile. Right, remember, how many of you remember when he debated Mondale in that re-election campaign? And he couldn't hardly speak. He couldn't answer any of the questions. The Wall Street Journal put a front page story on. But he was always recovering, so it became confusing. He would show a sign that he was faltering, and then he'd bounce back, and he'd do something quite appealing and impressive and seeming to be all together. And my story with him was that I had a meeting with him. Boy, he was completely out of it, totally out of it. I had my family with me, And it was so embarrassing. He didn't seem to recognize me or know what was happening in the room. And I babbled, because I don't know about you, when there's silence, I just started to talk. And I said to him, my daughter was there. I said, she was about 9 at the time. And I said, when Jimmy Carter was president, my daughter told everybody that the president works for my mommy. And I said, the minute you got to be president, she inverted it. She said, my mommy works for the president. And I thought, you know, even a 9-year-old could tell the difference between a guy who didn't look strong and a president who did. And I thought it was a charming story. Nothing. It was as if he didn't hear me. Nothing happened. No eyes. Nothing. And it kept going like that. And so I was preparing to do a story that night saying that the president was senile. I was going to do it. I was forming it in my head. Press secretary. And we're still in there. My husband, my daughter, and I. And my husband, a screenwriter, who wrote not only the story in Esquire, but the screenplay for Urban Cowboy and others. The press secretary comes right up close to Reagan and practically screams in his face, because he was also deaf. He said, Aaron's a screenwriter. He writes movies. So now Reagan, who's been standing there, his head shaking and he's quivering a little bit, pops to life, completely pops to life. Animated. I mean, the age spots went away. The foam on his eyes went away. And he grabbed my husband by the shoulders and he walked him away from me, took him over to this corner of the Oval Office and started to talk about how he wanted to go back into movies when he wasn't president anymore and he had an idea for a screenplay. We leave the Oval Office. We're out in the hall and he comes bounding out. I'm not making one bit of this up. He was bounding out and he says, Taylor, that's my daughter's name, I can't let you leave here without telling you the truth. We turn around. I remember he was tall and my daughter looked up at him and he said, I work for your mother too. He heard everything. I didn't know what to do. I obviously couldn't say it was senile. I don't know what I saw that day. I have no idea what I saw. But he heard everything. He just didn't respond. I don't know.
So it was confusing.
Totally confusing. And if you ask people who worked in the White House, which I did a lot to figure out what I was going to say in the book, some people in the White House felt he was faltering and others felt he wasn't. And after I got to 60 Minutes, I did a story. Reagan was still alive, but the Alzheimer's had been announced. I interviewed his son. Mm-hmm. And Ron Reagan said that he thought that his father showed signs of senility when he was president and said he was never the same after he was shot. But then I've had other people who worked with him in the White House who would have no reason now not to tell the truth, said absolutely not.
Not a
sign of it at all. So,
and the story about his being shot, whether it was totally manipulated or not, was how fast he bounced back, and it was extraordinary, so
right.
Who knows?
But he was in much worse condition than they ever told us. And Maureen Reagan, who died, you know, she had breast cancer, she died. She told me back then an incredible story about how desperately ill he was and how he was that close to death, and they never told us.
Well, before we get into 60 Minutes and some current events, because we're here at the JCC, I want to do some Jewish stuff. So, you are Jewish.
I am Jewish.
And, in fact, I understand you have Passover with Cokie and Steve Roberts. Is that true?
Well, I'm not very religious. And my husband is a Methodist, and he's not very religious. So, we didn't do much with our daughter. So, Cokie Roberts, who's Catholic, but married to Steve Roberts, who's not, did all the holidays, every holiday, for every religion you can ever think of. We would go to her house for Passover.
Sounds like a nice tradition.
Yeah,
and you mentioned a little earlier, you did a roots trip.
I did a roots trip with my cousins to go find where my grandfather had grown up in Vladava, Poland. And we found the place. And the my grandfather came here in 1900 with his whole family. And I was told that the Nazis destroyed everything. every single solitary thing. And Vladava was a small city, or a large town, I don't know. But they had a synagogue. And it was the only big building in the whole area, the only really large building. The Nazis used it to store a military materiel. So it's still standing. And of course, there are no Jews, none in that part of Poland, zero. But they keep it up. And they reverted to a synagogue. There are no pews. It's not used for religious purposes, but it's standing there. And we went in there, and I stood where my grandfather was bar mitzvahed. Mm. And it was, I'm going to cry telling you.
What a great,
pretty something.
Great trip.
Stunning. Just stunning.
So a couple of years ago, I think it was a 60 Minutes story, you had a House Majority Leader Eric Cantor on, and you asked him, he's a Republican, and you did a pretty hard-hitting interview with him, as is your wont, and you asked him, well, essentially, why are you a Republican? Most Jews are Democrats. And the reaction from the right-wing press was crazy.
You know, I don't remember that.
Oh, yeah.
I remember.
Look online.
Here's what I remember.
Look online.
I said to him, taxes was a big deal at that point. And there was a whole dispute with Obama over whether they were going to raise taxes, not raise taxes. And I said to him, well, Ronald Reagan raised taxes. He raised taxes a lot. He raised taxes 16 times. And before he could answer, his press secretary, I've never had this happen. I've been at 60 Minutes for 24 years. This has never, ever, ever happened. The press secretary screams out in the middle of the interview and said, liar, to me, that I had made that up. And it was shocking in the room, shocking. I turned around. I mean, no matter what he said, it would have been shocking. But it was true. And Eric Cantor couldn't recover. It was really a stunning moment.
They covered that too, but I was more interested in the Jewish part.
I don't remember the Jewish part. I don't think I knew about this reaction.
Yeah, well, I'll send you
some
links.
Because I wasn't reading that. I don't know. Do you all know about that?
I'll send the links to everybody.
All right, send the links.
You were here recently participating in Stanford's roundtable discussion on climate change, and I know you're very proud of the series you did, Years of Living Dangerously, a 9-part series dealing with climate change, and you went to Greenland, and you're very passionate about this. So tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, okay. Did any of you see any of the Years of Living Dangerously episodes? Oh, one hand. It was on Showtime. Another one. It was on Showtime. It was a multi-part, maybe 20 parts, ran over several weeks, all about global warming. And Arnold Schwarzenegger did a story as a reporter, and Tom Friedman did one. They had movie stars and reporters mixed together. And my story was on the glaciers in Greenland melting. And I went up there, and you can see it happening. You can absolutely see the glacier just falling away into the ocean. And now the ocean levels are rising all along the East Coast, all coming from the glaciers melting in Greenland. Greenland was white. I don't know why they ever called it Greenland. It was completely white with a huge, thick layer of ice and snow. And all the people in Greenland, by the way, which I didn't know till I got there, Greenlanders are Eskimos. They look exactly like our Eskimos, exactly. So there they are, living on the ice. They all have sleds and sled dogs, and the ice is melting. And their way of life is vanishing before their eyes. It's an astonishing thing. So that's an interesting thing. On the other side, as the ice melts, they are discovering all kinds of precious metals, gold, diamonds, and oil. So in terms of global warming, the ice is melting, and now they're going to go out into the sea and on land and find more oil, and we'll have more global warming. So, anyway, it was an extraordinary trip. and I found out that I have a passion for and fell madly in love with icebergs because they're real. They move, and they're beautiful, mm-hmm. and they shine. And if you look at them 1 minute, they look like a dog, and then they move, and they look like a person, or they have life. Mm-hmm. They absolutely have life.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features broadcast journalist Leslie Stahl. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So a couple of questions just about current events, and then we'll turn it over to the audience, so get your questions ready. Cuba, how do you think coverage is going to change? I guess there are bureaus that are going to be set up there. What's the conversation inside news about covering Cuba?
To be honest, I haven't heard any. You know, 60 Minutes, we are this little funny enclave. We don't even work in the same building as everybody else. When Don Hewitt created 60 Minutes, he wanted it to be its own separate operation off to the side, and we are. So that would be something that the hard news side would establish a bureau there or whatever. Mm-hmm. The truth is, I don't think we'll have a bureau there because we don't have bureaus anymore. We used to have them all over the world. When I started at 60 Minutes, we had bureaus all across Europe. We had bureaus in Germany, in Moscow, in Rome, in Paris, in London. We had them in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv. We had them all across Latin America, the Far East. And I think we have about three left. So we probably won't set up a bureau, but they'll work out of Miami. That's what will happen.
Well, the other big story, there are a number of them today, but there was a story on 60 Minutes last night with your new correspondent, Bill Whitaker, who's been around Northern California for a long time, about the Cleveland Police Department. And of course, Ferguson, there's so much in the news now.
New York.
So as a consumer of news, what is your assessment of the coverage of race in America? How good a job have we done? What do we need to do a better job?
Well, I think the press covers this issue quite a bit. Obviously, we don't resolve anything. But I think we cover the story, particularly this story of the police departments. I think our knowledge of the unfairness in the judicial system based on race, I think everybody understands that the sentencing is harsher. The incarceration rates are much higher. We know that. We know that from the reporting. We report and nothing happens. We report and nothing happens. People think that if you do a story on 60 Minutes, it's going to make all the difference. I can't tell you how many important stories I personally and all the rest of us have done, and they get a little attention, maybe a hearing in Congress, and then nothing. So I think the story gets a lot of coverage without much being done. You know, nothing gets done unless the public rises up. That's the truth. If you don't complain, you don't write your congressman, you don't scream and yell in some way, nothing will change.
Recently, the grand dame of television news woman retired, Barbara Walters, and you had
she retires and then she doesn't retire.
Yeah, is she retired?
No,
I guess that's the question.
I don't want her to retire. I love her, so I want to see her, but I just saw her.
Was she a role model for you when you were coming up?
Well, she was, when I started, really, she was doing the Today Show. And then she started doing more hard news when I was already there. So I wouldn't really say a role model, but I think she's the best. She could do anything. She could cover any kind of story, whatever. She could cover a human interest story, an investigative story. She interviewed everybody. And she really had a tough time coming up,
yeah.
A seriously tough time at the Today Show. And then when she became the anchor woman with Harry Reasoner, and he let everybody know he didn't like her.
Yeah.
It was rough.
So just put up your hand.
Be kind.
And take your questions.
Huh?
Barbara was kind.
Oh, kind. Oh, I have some tough ones left.
No, don't. Let's
see. Right here down in the center?
Come here.
With the gorgeous necklace.
Leslie, it's Rita Moreno.
Oh!
Oh, my word. Stand up and let everybody see you. Come on, look at you.
Yeah.
Hi, sweetheart.
I can handle this. Thank you. Okay, I want to ask you two questions.
Okay.
The first is,
why are you here?
Because my daughter Fernanda had the tickets, and I didn't even know you were coming to town. And when
do
I heard,
you live here?
Yeah, we both live in the East Bay.
I thought you lived in New York.
Across the bridge, And we love you. That's why we're here. We love you, and you look gorgeous. Okay, the real question. I would love to have you mention, if you can, some of the women journalists and reporters whose work you admire. Surely there's more than one, and I would love to know who they are.
Okay, well, I'm going to do only broadcast, because I admire a lot of the print women. But when I started in Washington, there were very few. And over the years, CBS hired Rita Braver, who covered the Justice Department for us, Susan Spencer, who it was the best political reporter we had, fabulous. And these women are still around, by the way. That's one of the reasons I'm mentioning them. I was hired with Connie Chung, who is still a friend of mine. She's not really working too much in television, but she's just the most lovely person, and funny and delightful. When I worked in Washington, I was very, very friendly with the women at NPR. Mm. Koki, one of my best friends, and Linda Wertheimer was one of my close friends, and Nina Totenberg. So those three women and a couple of other women, a woman pollster, whose name was Dottie Lynch. We were in a ladies' lunch group because we spent all day with men. We each worked at a news organization, except the women on NPR, but the rest of us worked only with men, and we craved the company of women. So we would get together. Judy Woodruff, she's sensational. She's great. She was a White House correspondent with me. She covered Jimmy Carter at the White House. You know, if you look at network television today, there are loads and loads of women. And they're
that doesn't mean they're all terrific.
Yeah, they're all mostly terrific. They're really good. I mean, women work harder. They do. And it's still a little bit of a slog to get there. So you can be sure that if they're doing reporting, I'm not talking about the talkers. I'm not talking about the talk show types. I'm talking about the women out on the street, inside or outside the street. You see a lot of women. And I think that journalism is a profession that suits women. I think it takes a lot of intuition and good writing. And women are comfortable in this profession. And the profession basically welcomes us. You know, there always were women reporters. You go back to World War II, World War I, and even before that, there were women in this profession. I just was reading about Martha Gellhorn.
Oh, yeah.
So it goes, I mean, it is a wonderful, frankly, wonderful career. And there are loads of terrific women in it. I'm glad you asked that question.
So you alluded to the notion that the news cycle, you didn't put it this way, but that it's really fast, that, you know, you used to work the phones all day, and now it's, you know, something happens and you go live. Not you, but, you know. So, and then you talk about the fact that there aren't bureaus any longer either. And you talk about journalism being the wonderful profession that it is, all of which is true. So what I'm wondering is, from your perspective, given the fact that people are not working, maybe they're working sources, but it doesn't really appear the way it once did in that respect. So is everybody essentially reporting the same news? And are the journalists not journalists any longer? And what do you see as the future of journalism, given how fast our lives just move? Thank you, Google.
Well, I think that, like everything else now, there are pockets. So 60 Minutes does it the old-fashioned way. Online, we're beginning to see developing investigative reporting sites. The former editor at the New York Times, his name I'm not going to be able to pull up, just...
Bill Keller
started a business, online business, for investigative reporting. I think just going to be in the criminal justice area. Someone else is doing one in health and so forth. And we're going to have to find these sites to get in-depth reporting. I think the New York Times is in-depth as it's ever been, if not more. I think the Washington Post, since Bezos bought it, has become a very, very serious, excellent newspaper again, and the Wall Street Journal is terrific in terms of print. I don't know about you, but I'm still watching the NewsHour on PBS. So I think my point is that if you search out the kind of reporting you want and crave, you're going to be able to find it. There's so much out there. There's so much of everything out there. But you're going to have to search for it. It's not going to be the way it was in the old days, where there were three television networks and that was it. And a lot of people think what we have now is dreadful, and I may be one of them. But I think that we're in a shakedown period in terms of how we consume information, meaning that we're in transition. The internet has produced this vast open space without barriers, without walls, and we're going to have to build those barriers and walls over time. But right now, it's just wild. But I think it'll sort itself out, and hard news journalism will be found. I can't tell you how many schools of journalism I've been to, and the kids are so enthusiastic about doing serious work. They're going to make it happen. Right now, I don't think it's a great profession. I don't think... if you look at how many sites there are, that there's going to be a critical mass at any one of them for a while for a kid to make have a really strong career in terms of earnings. But eventually it's going to all shake itself out, I'm sure of it.
I had two questions. The first is feeding into what you were just talking about, the internet phenomenon, how that's changing information in the world, is that many broadcast journalists have either had to resign or suspended because online they voiced very strong political opinions that in the past would not have happened. And this feeds into the actual presentation of broadcast journalism, where that sort of the unbiased presentation has become a wider scope, where you see more and more broadcast journalists voicing opinions through commentaries or gestures. So I wanted to ask your opinion of that in terms of the unbiased journalism that people used to expect. And then the other second question I had was about the role of a network like Al Jazeera as a global news source from a particular viewpoint, and what to see what you thought about that as well.
Well, they go together. I think that journalism generally is moving toward position journalism. And it's more like the old days when the country first started and there were hundreds of newspapers, and you knew if you picked up this one that you were getting the right wing, and if you picked up that one, you were getting the left wing. And we're just moving there. We are. What they call mainstream press is shrinking. So you'll get an opinion, but you'll know, hopefully, that it is an opinion, and you'll make your judgments based on where you're getting your your information. I think it's a shame, but that's my opinion, and I'm getting to be something of a fuddy-duddy. I think the bigger problem is not having opinion thrown at me as much as not knowing what's accurate and what's not accurate on the internet. And there's no policeman, that's probably the wrong word, but there's no one telling you this is not true. It all goes out with the same level of decibel level and intensity level, the facts and the made-up fantasies. And that's going to have to be sorted out. We are going to have to figure out where we want to go for our information that suits us. One of the problems, too, in doing that is that we're only listening to what we want to hear, and we're not being challenged enough. So, sadly, it's going to be up to us as individuals to seek out the kind of information we want. We want to go to a site that we know is reliable. Do we want to go to a site that we know is going to present both sides of an issue? That's who we are. That's what we want. We'll find it. If you only want to be in the echo chamber, you'll find that. How many of you listened to the Serial story on radio? Oh, not very many. I recommend it. Mm-hmm. It's a whole new kind of journalism. And I loved it. I loved it. Now, you knew of this girl, this woman who did this report on a murder. A young man was convicted of a murder, and she went to investigate whether he was properly convicted. And she kept telling you what she was thinking as she went through her investigation. I think he's guilty. Do I think of the lawyer and so forth? And I loved it. And that was opinion journalism. But at least she was wearing it on her sleeve. She wasn't telling us that this is a fact. She would separate the fact from what she was thinking. And I think that's the future. My daughter, who's 37, always complained to me that she never knew where reporters like me, where we were coming from. Well, what do you think? You spent all that time doing that reporting. What do you think? Why don't you tell us what you think? Well, she wants that, and I think her generation wants that.
Thanks to all of you. Thank you. Leslie Stahl.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and 91.7 KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was broadcast journalist Leslie Stahl. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Brandon Battaglia, Ben Tuttle, and Maya Finley. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I invite you to tune in again next Thursday at noon, when Bina will feature cognitive neuroscientist Michael Gazzaniga. I'm Barbara Lane. Thanks for listening.